Chapter 5. Message from a Mastodon. The San Diego Natural History Museum, affectionately known to locals as the Nat, is situated in the lush gardens of Balboa Park, which served as the venue for the 1915 Panama-California Exposition. Originally called City Park, it was renamed for the exposition in honor of Spanish-born Vasco Núñez de Balboa, who conducted a murderous exploratory raid across Panama and became the first European to see the Pacific Ocean. Balboa Park was repurposed after the closure of the exposition and now hosts 17 museums and cultural institutions, among which the Nat stands out for its excellent collections and for its research expertise. As Santa and I strolled towards it on a bright Southern California morning, we couldn't help but reflect on the irony. In a museum, in a park named after an arrivist European adventurer, we were about to be shown evidence that might speak to the truly vast antiquity of Native Americans in the lands that Europeans had stolen from them with fire and sword. Rebecca Handelsman had asked us to meet her at the Nat's south entrance, but we were early, so we spent some time in the north atrium first, which is dominated by a looming skeleton cast of an allosaur, a predatory dinosaur, a bit like its more famous younger cousin, Tyrannosaurus rex. Scientists now agree that T. rex and the entire non-avian Dinosauria clade became extinct virtually overnight after a large asteroid or comet, more likely the latter, hit the Gulf of Mexico around 65 million years ago. There is also no doubt that it was this sudden and cataclysmic eradication of dinosaurs from the planet that opened the way for the rapid, uncontested expansion into new niches of the hitherto insignificant mammalian line. We humans today are among the descendants of those early mammals. It's thought-provoking, isn't it, that cosmic impacts, whether by asteroids or by comets, can sometimes be of such magnitude that they drastically redirect the evolutionary path of life on Earth. It has happened more than once, as we shall see. However, a cataclysm was not to blame 130,000 years ago when a lone mastodon, perhaps old or sick, died on a floodplain in Southern California and was subsequently scavenged, with the carcass then quite rapidly covered by and entombed in a deposit of silty, sandy, fine-grained sediment. There it remained, undisturbed, until November 1992, when the California Department of Transportation undertook highway construction on State Route 54, where San Diego borders National City. It was routine practice for paleontologists from the Nat to monitor road grading in Southern California in case any important fossil material was exposed. And Richard Cerruti, the monitor on duty at SR-54, spotted the fossilized bones and the tusk of what he at first thought was a mammoth. He halted construction in the immediate vicinity until a proper excavation could be undertaken and called in his boss, Dr. Tom Demaray, to lead it. Working together with a team of other researchers from the Nat, Cerruti and Demaray very quickly established that the fossilized remains, including many bones, both tusks, and several of the animal's teeth, belonged to a mastodon. Like the mammoths, to which they were closely related, mastodons were swept from the face of the earth in the sudden and mysterious extinction of America's Ice Age megafauna that took place around 12,800 years ago. The same epoch exactly that saw the equally abrupt and equally mysterious disappearance of the Clovis culture. From quite early on, both Cerruti, after whom the site is now named, and Demaray were intrigued by what the excavation revealed. Many of the bones were strangely fractured or missing entirely, and there were several large stones found in the same sediment layer as the bones and teeth that appeared out of place. It looked like an archaeological site, like the preserved evidence of human activity. As well as the hefty rocks, unusual in fine-grained sediment, smaller pieces of sharply broken stone were found peppered throughout the Cerruti mastodon site. This is not typically something you would see as a result of normal geological processes. The combination of stones, together with broken bones, was interesting and instigated speculation regarding the possibility of human activity at the site. At first intriguing, the implications of the data grew worrying when it began to become obvious that the site was extremely ancient, lying embedded in sediments that had been deposited much earlier, during a period long before humans were thought to have arrived on the continent. In the early 1990s, radiometric techniques capable of peering much further back into the past than the standard 50,000-year limit for carbon dating were already available. Unfortunately, however, they had not yet attained sufficient accuracy to give scientists a high level of confidence in the age range suspected for the Cerruti Mastodon site. The end result, after key finds were moved to the Nat, where they were housed in the archives, was that the site was reburied and abandoned. Despite its anomalous character and suspected importance, it was just too explosive to put before the scrutiny of hostile archaeologists while the dates remained uncertain. "If you claim something is that old, you get blasted," Cerruti said, referring to the Clovis First lobby, which is why some archaeologists stopped working on sites like this. They didn't want to get blasted. It wasn't that the Cerruti Mastodon site was completely forgotten in the 25 years after the excavation stopped. It's on record that Tom Demaray invited several other researchers to study the collection of key finds kept at the Nat, but none did so. Robson Bonichen, founder of the Center for the Study of the First Americans, warned him that research that contributes to First American studies is a game of hardball. Months ran into years, with no journal article on the site even drafted, let alone published, nor any further investigation undertaken. Cerruti reportedly was so disappointed that he stopped going anywhere near State Route 54. The whole exciting matter seemed to have fallen into stagnation. It was not until 2014, more than two decades after the Mastodon's discovery, that the tide decisively turned. Built on improved understanding of processes that incorporate natural uranium and its decay products in fossil bone, a newly enhanced technique known as 230 THU radiometric dating was now available that could settle the age of the Cerruti deposit once and for all. Demaray therefore sent several of the mastodon bones to the U.S. Geological Survey in Colorado, where geologist Jim Paces, using the updated and refined technique, established beyond reasonable doubt that the bones were buried 130,000 years ago. Now things began to move much more swiftly, and it was time to re-examine the strange fractures on some of the bones that had been noticed back in 1992, and also to take a much closer look at the out-of-place stones and rocks found in the same sediment layer. To this end, the large and eclectic team of investigators who would eventually co-author the landmark 2017 paper in Nature had already begun to form. Tom Demaray and Richard Cerruti were at the heart of it, but other members included Dr. Steve Holan, curator of archaeology at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science, a specialist in the ancient uses of bone, Professor Daniel Fisher of the Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences, University of Michigan, Dr. Richard Fulgar of the Center for Archaeological Science, University of Wollongong, and Dr. James Paces, research geologist at the U.S. Geological Survey. It was a formidable team. Their work was meticulous, and publication of the paper in Nature meant that archaeologists just then, cautiously emerging from the shadow of the Clovis First paradigm and adjusting themselves with difficulty to ages in the few tens of thousands of years for sites like Monteverde, Meadowcroft, and Bluefish Caves, were now obliged to contemplate a site dating back to the Eemian, the last interglacial period, that extended from roughly 140,000 years ago down to about 120,000 years ago when the Pleistocene ice sheets began to expand again. At that point, in 2017, it was still believed, though new evidence would soon substantially change the picture, that anatomically modern humans had not even left their African homeland 140,000 years ago. So how could they possibly have gotten to America before they'd even set out on the epic migrations by which they populated the world? Having researched the Clovis First Wars, and indeed the whole story of prehistoric archaeology in the United States from the late 19th century onward, I was just beginning to realize how staggering the implications of all this really were. Tom Demarais's Bones and Stones. The Gnat's main atrium, where the Allosaur lurks, is accessed through the museum's north entrance. So just before 11 a.m, Santa and I walked around the west side of the four-story building and presented ourselves at the south entrance. Beyond it was a second atrium, where we were encouraged to see that much of the space was devoted to a well-attended exhibition honouring the Ceruti mastodon site. Out of the crowd, Rebecca Handelsman appeared. Tom Demarais would join us in a moment, she said. While we waited, she walked us over to a display case containing a mock-up of the sediment matrix from the site, into which, point down and visible through the glass side of the case, was set a mastodon tusk. It was a little shorter than my arm, but it was obviously not complete, as the upper part had been crudely broken off. "This is the tusk that first attracted Richard Ceruti's attention," Rebecca explained, and before I could ask, she added, "its upper part was clipped off by the backhoe before he could stop the construction work." "Is the way it's displayed here the way it was found?" I asked. "Exactly that way." She paused and waved. "Look, here's Tom. He can tell you all about it." Weaving through the crowd was a man of pleasant aspect, spare and lean after a lifetime of field work, wearing blue jeans and a brick-red shirt. From my background reading, I knew he was 69 years old, though he appeared younger, and as we shook hands, I saw he had penetrating grey eyes and an easy smile. Despite the risk to his reputation of even talking to a pseudoscientist like me, he seemed relaxed and friendly. I launched straight in on the subject of the tusk. "What's so special about it?" I asked Tom. "The way it was set into the ground," he replied, "so it would have stood upright. The other one lay in a natural horizontal position beside it, but this one was found like you see it in the display, vertical, and that to us immediately looked like an anomaly." "Why?" "One suggestion is that it was perhaps left there as a marker to come back to the site on a floodplain where everything is low relief. I mean, who knows? I don't know what sort of non-cultural process would put a tusk vertical. I just don't understand it." "So what you're saying is that this looks like the result of human behavior, that it's evidence of a deliberate, intelligent act." "It seems like that to me and to many others, though I have to say our critics aren't persuaded. I take this as my cue to ask Tom if he and his team had been surprised by the level of skeptical response to the Nature paper." "I expected we'd have pushback," he replied. "I just hoped it would have been more objective." "I suppose that in any profession and any career, people get very emotionally involved." "Apparently," Tom laughed. "I'm not used to it from a paleontological standpoint. I mean, there's passion in paleontology too, but I'm not used to this sort of thing." I restrain myself from stating my view that this sort of thing, namely sniping, quibbling, misrepresentation, strawman arguments, and vituperative ad hominem attacks leveled against anyone suggesting deep antiquity for the first Americans, is perfectly normal among archaeologists, and Santa and I gratefully accept Tom's offer to talk us through the exhibits. "The anomalous tusk is just a small part of the story," he says. "The stronger evidence comes from the mastodon's fossilized bones and from the rocks and stones of various sizes found distributed around the site. In humans, the femur is the long bone of the thigh. At its upper end, it has a ball-like protrusion, the femur head, that articulates with a socket in the pelvis, and thus, wondrous nature enables us to walk. Though they stood on four legs, it was no different for mastodons. Their femora were their upper hind limbs, and just like our femora, were surmounted by ball-like heads set into their pelvic sockets." Tom draws our attention to the hefty, almost hemispherical detached heads of the mastodon's two femora, one with the rounded end down, the other with the rounded end up, sitting side by side in a display case. "This is how they were found when we excavated them," he says. And he points out a rock next to them that he calls an anvil stone, adding that there wasn't much left of the femora themselves. The significance of this is not immediately obvious to me, so I ask Tom to elaborate. "We suggest that this was a workstation," he says, "that both femora were hammered and broken here on the anvil stone, and that the heads were detached and just set off to the side. It feels purposeful, like the tusk. It feels like humans were breaking those bones. And it's not only what's here that's important, but also what's not here. I mean, originally the femora from which these heads came were 3 feet in length and massively thick, yet we have just a few pieces of them. So that would suggest what, I ask, that the other pieces were taken away? Yes, Demaray replies. I mean, if it was equipment damage, you'd think you'd have the whole femur, right? So the fact that we have missing bits suggests to us that they were taken away, which fits this idea of human processing and transportation. In the next display case are the few large fragments of femur that were found at the site, and multiple smaller flakes of bone that were found lying around them. We interpret these as cone flakes, Tom explains. So when a bone is struck by a stone hammer, you have damage on the impact side, but you also have these flakes come out on the other side. At the point of impact, you have a small hole, and the exit point of that impact is a larger hole, and so these are flakes that are created by impacts. I suppose one question would be, they took away bits of the femora, so why didn't they take the tusks? Because the tusks, presumably, would have offered them useful materials too. But they're also heavy, Tom points out, whereas bones are relatively transportable. We have a pattern, and the pattern begs for an explanation, and what we feel fits that pattern is human transportation. Did you find anything that was obviously a tool, I ask? No. Tom appears untroubled by what some critics regard as a fatal argument against his case. I seek clarification. So if we're saying that humans did this, then we're saying that they just took advantage of natural rocks and they used those as hammers and anvils, basically. That's one of the problems the skeptics have, Tom admits cheerfully. That there are no fashioned tools, no flaked stone tools, that there are no knives, no scrapers, no choppers. But if I'm correct, I interrupt, you're arguing that can be explained because what these ancient humans were doing was extracting the marrow from the bones. They were smashing up the bones. They didn't particularly need fine tools for this. That's what we're saying, Tom confirms. We're saying that this was a carcass. It wasn't killed by these humans. It wasn't even butchered by these humans. Most likely, it was a carcass at an advanced stage of decomposition, but it still had potential for the extraction of marrow from the bones. Some critics have claimed that it was the backhoe, or the grader, or other equipment used in the roadworks that broke the bones, I point out. Others have argued that they were broken by being rolled against rocks carried along in river water when the surrounding sediment was laid down. Tom raises an eyebrow. Flow velocities that are strong enough to transport rocks like the big anvil stones are going to carry all the finer material much further away. Yet we still have all that fine material at the site. Small stones, small bone fragments, and obviously the associated silt and sand too. So there really is a disjunct in terms of the hydrology. Addressing the suggestion of Ceruti skeptic Gary Haynes that the bones were broken by the road-making equipment in 1992, Tom launches into a long and detailed exposition. It's too technical to try the listener's patience with here, but the takeaway is that a recently broken, fossilized bone has a very different appearance to a bone broken when it was still fresh within a short time of the animal's death. Experiments carried out by Demaray's colleague Steve Holan on the bones of a recently deceased African elephant showed that the characteristic spinal fractures that occur when you deliberately and systematically break fresh bone between a stone hammer and a stone anvil in no way resemble the fractures caused by the teeth of scavengers or predators and simply cannot occur in fossilized bones. The presence of spiral fractures among the bones of the Ceruti mastodon therefore leads to the inevitable conclusion that they must have been broken 130,000 years ago, when they were fresh. Meanwhile, the presence of the hammer and anvil stones and the evidence of how they were used to break the bones makes it equally certain that humans were involved. Because, I muse, nothing else is going to smash up those bones and take out the marrow in that way. That's how we see it, Tom confirms, but I'm a scientist, so I'm open to alternative explanations if they fit the data better than ours. And so it's possible that we are wrong. But the evidence suggests to us that the only explanation for the taphonomic data at this site is that humans were responsible. Taphonomy is the study of the circumstances and processes of fossilization, a field that is generally better understood by paleontologists like Tom than by archaeologists. If you don't look, you won't find. After we've completed our tour of the exhibits, Tom takes us behind the scenes at the museum, into areas off-limits to the public. As we ride the elevator up to the fourth floor, I ask him if it was a struggle to get the Nature paper accepted. Well, it was a year-long review process, he replies. Rigorous, which you'd expect. I tried publishing in Nature before. It's not an easy journal to get into. So we were excited when they sent it out for review. That's really the first hurdle, if it gets off the editor's desk. Then we went through several rounds of revisions and re-review and re-revision, but eventually it was accepted. So that was really exciting. It's a terrific journal. And that's the other thing, of course. It's Nature. It's not some third or fourth tier publication. Absolutely top tier, I agree, as we step out of the elevator, which is why it's had such a huge impact. I've been following the story of the peopling of the Americas, and for a very long while, there was extreme resistance around the so-called Clovis First model. I mean, that was it. It was almost dangerous career-wise to propose anything else. Apparently, Tom says. And then the evidence starts to come in, I continue, and starts to just overwhelm that paradigm. We begin to open up to the possibility of 14,000, 15,000, 18,000, 25,000 years. And you can see the archaeological community kind of reluctantly embracing that. But then you come along with 130,000 years, and that is a time bomb. Literally, it's a huge explosion. Tom's expression is rueful. It wasn't our intention. It was just where the evidence led us. We enter the Nat's archives, where the larger part of the Ceruti mastodon collection is permanently stored in a secure room in three huge cabinets. An Indiana Jones moment follows as Tom grabs a four-spoked steel wheel and spins it. Soundlessly, the cabinets slide apart. Avenues appear between them, and then Tom is opening drawers and showing us mastodon bones and mastodon teeth and more pieces of rock and stone while Santa takes photographs and we continue talking. The more I see, the more persuaded I am and the better I understand why Nature published Tom's paper. Despite the whines and quibbles of the skeptics, the evidence, once it's laid out in front of you, once you actually look at the bones and stones, and once the technical details are properly considered, is absolutely solid and convincing. What's next, I ask? How do you take this further? Well, of course, one of the things we've said all along to our critics is that if you don't look in deposits of this age with the idea in mind that evidence of humans could be there, then you're not going to find anything. So we're suggesting as a challenge that people should start considering, should start to look in these deposits as a way of testing this hypothesis. I know that's a lot of work, but there are unexamined deposits of this age throughout the US. It's also good science, I comment. I mean, not just to rest on a paradigm, but to try to look for other possibilities. Again, I'm struck by the emotional nature of the reaction your paper has provoked. Some people are quite reasonable, but others almost insultingly reject the whole thing. Dismissive, Tom agrees. So I guess the reaction I was looking for was healthy skepticism, but with the idea of, well, let's look at this now. Let's consider this and what the implications are and what sort of predictions can we make about testing this. But that's been a minority of the reactions. We've seen the extremes of both. Some people say this is pure garbage, and others say this is the find of the century. But what we're saying to everyone, really, is open your mind to the possibility that instead of the peopling of the Americas being associated with the last deglaciation event, the so-called Bolling-Alarod Interstadial, dated from around 14,700 years ago to around 12,800 years ago, what we should actually be looking at is the deglaciation event before that, between 140,000 years ago and 120,000 years ago. You get the same sort of scenario with a land bridge and ice sheets retreating, and you get that same sweet spot between really low sea levels and a blockage by ice sheets and ice sheets gone and the flooding of the land bridge. And yet, I reflect, so much else changes if you're right. The peopling of the Americas becomes a whole different story, much more complicated. Well, Tom suggests, it becomes richer. A much richer and longer story, I agree. So much so, in fact, that it's really hard for a lot of archaeologists to swallow when they're committed to a shorter time frame. I hesitate before raising my next point. Look, I know we're not supposed to talk about this, but your date of 130,000 years ago raises the possibility that it might have been Neanderthals who were at your site, or Denisovans, or anatomically modern humans, because they were all in the world at that time. With this comment, I've taken us into territory I'd specifically agreed would be off-limits when my request for an interview was accepted. But Tom seems happy to express his point of view. As a paleontologist, he muses, I ask the question, why weren't there human beings here earlier? I mean, we have dispersal of Eurasian animal species into North America and dispersal of North American species into Eurasia at earlier times. So why shouldn't humans have been here as well? And now it looks like they were. I'm certain of that, Tom says, from our evidence. Which raises the question of why, in 150 years of professional study, archaeologists have failed to find similar evidence. There's always the possibility, Tom offers, that our site witnesses a failed colonization attempt. So you had this dispersal event, it didn't take, maybe because population size wasn't great enough, and they quite quickly died out. In which case, they would have left almost no trace of their presence for archaeologists to find. Then thousands of years later, there was a successful colonization by other migrants, and naturally, they dominate the archaeological record. It could be like that, I concede. But on the other hand, it could be that there were people here all along, and they've just been invisible to archaeology because of the particular way archaeology works and the particular things archaeology looks for. You'd have to ask the archaeologists, Tom shrugs. But like I say, if you go to a place and you absolutely rule out in advance that humans were there 130,000 years ago, then you're clearly not going to find evidence that they were. But if you go with an open mind and dig deep enough in the right places, then who knows what you might turn up.